Hello and welcome to Inside Education. You can visit our website insideed.com to listen to or download podcasts of 134 previous Inside Education programmes. I'm Sean Delaney and I'll be your host for the next 30 minutes or so. Coming up on this week's programme.
Basically, that you start from where the students are and you actually activate what they know, which seems to be counterintuitive to many teachers. Why would you teach and you spend waste very important instructional time on something that kids already know?
If children in your class are having problems learning maths, it is possible that they have failed to understand one or two key concepts. Mathematics education professor Ron Suhr will discuss two key mathematical ideas that children need to learn in primary school. But first, Barry Hennessy brings us a report from the world of education. You're welcome, Barry.
Hello again, Sean. We've talked a lot about the findings of the 2009 PISA report on this programme, but the latest results of the OECD International Literacy Study are sure to be of particular interest to students of the sociology of education. In its latest thematic report entitled Public and Private Schools, the OECD publishes data gathered during PISA 2009 regarding the socio-economic backgrounds of 15-year-olds attending particular schools and presents this data alongside their reading scores. Much of the media attention has focused on the fact that pupils attending fee-paying schools in Ireland have an average reading score of 539 on PISA compared to just 466 for pupils in vocational schools. But the criteria for this report actually regard all voluntary secondary schools in Ireland as being privately managed, thus blurring the line somewhat between public and private education. Gerry Scheel is a research fellow at the Educational Research Centre in Drumcondra, which coordinates PISA in Ireland. I first asked him if this definition makes it more difficult to compare Irish schools with those in other OECD countries.
I think it does, because in the case of Ireland, over 61% of students are categorised as attending private schools, and that's because, as you say, they are privately managed. The others are viewed as attending public schools. They would be students in vocational schools and community and comprehensive schools. And the big difference there is that the management boards of those schools are open to public appointment, as opposed to the secondary schools where they're private.
Now, in general, the findings that have come out this week show that privately managed schools, so again, in the case of Ireland, we're talking not just about fee-paying, but also about these non-fee-paying voluntary schools, they are found to cater for pupils from higher socioeconomic backgrounds than publicly managed schools. Why is that?
Well, I think a lot of it has to do with parental choice and higher SES parents, and in PISA they would be defined as parents in the kind of higher occupations, for want of another term. They would tend to be, I suppose, more selective in terms of where they send their students, where they send their children for post-primary schooling, and would tend to pick secondary schools, whether fee-paying or not. You have another category, for example, the Irish medium schools, which also tend to attract high SES students, even though they don't charge fees.
There'd probably be a lot of people out there who would, you know, readily defend the parents' right to choose the school that their children go to. But in terms of, I suppose, the factors that the schools themselves have control over with regard to their intake socioeconomically, admissions policies are seen, are they not, as having a significant effect on the background of children coming into schools?
They are indeed, yes. And I think we've made some good progress here in Ireland in recent years in terms of the fact that we're no longer allowed to use test results, achievement test results, as a criterion for admitting a child to post-primary school. But this report bears out the fact that brothers and sisters get priority preference in enrolling in many secondary schools, and this kind of leads to a continuity, I suppose. And it also, I suppose, leads to greater segregation across schools, you know, in terms of socioeconomic status. Now, we're not by any means the worst country in Europe in terms of segregation within our schools. In fact, we do quite well in that respect, despite the fact that we do have a number of fee-paying private schools, and despite the fact that we do tend to give priority to brothers and sisters of existing pupils during admission.
Although, if my reading of the report is correct, it's countries which tend to have less of a gap in terms of the socioeconomic profile of children going into schools that record overall better educational outcomes.
That's right, and I think that they would mainly refer to the Nordic countries, for example, Finland in particular, but also Sweden and Denmark, which would have comprehensive education systems at post-primary level. I don't think we're too far away from those countries in that we offer the same curriculum basically to all students. I know that there are different levels. We have the higher and ordinary and foundation levels and so forth. But we basically offer an academic curriculum to all students. If you take a look at, Germany or Austria, you find much larger differences in schools because they channel children into academic and vocational cycles at a relatively early age, sometimes as young as 11 or 12 years of age, and they get stuck in those channels then, and they would have difficulty moving out of them.
Sure, and in fact on this programme when we looked at the PISA issue in detail back in the autumn, we had a number of international experts, not least from the World Bank, who argued that, you know, getting children to specialise later is a deciding factor in raising your PISA score.
And that's one of the features of those Nordic countries as well, that, that the kind of differentiation doesn't occur until a later stage.
You know?
Yeah. But it's also important not to overlook the differentiation within schools, and I think that that's something that we probably need to reflect on more here, where we do split students into, say, higher and ordinary level classes at a fairly early stage in post-primary schooling. Now, there is some progress in that respect, and I know in relation to the new Project Maths that students are expected to work together regardless of ability level for at least the first year of post-primary schooling in mathematics. In English, a lot of schools don't tend to differentiate students maybe until the third year, so I think we're making some progress in that respect, but I think we need to look at it more closely as well. I think research by the ESRI in the past has pointed out the difficulties of separating students out at too early a stage and the negative effects that has on the lower achieving students in particular.
That's Gerry Shiel from the Educational Research Centre in Drumcondra, and we'll put a copy of that OECD report on public and private schools on insideed.com. That's it from me for this week. Sean.
Thanks for that, Barry. And Barry Hennessy will be back with another report on next week's programme. You're listening to Inside Education on 103.2 Dublin City FM. Podcasts of previous programmes can be downloaded from iTunes or from our website insideed.com. Two key mathematical ideas that children in primary school need to master are counting on and multiplicative reasoning. If children really grasp these ideas, they will find it easier to learn maths. But these ideas can be difficult for young children. In order to find out more about the ideas and how children can learn them, I met up with Professor Ron Sewer from the University of Colorado, Denver. Having grown up on Kibbutz Mishmar Hamek in Israel, he became a mathematics teacher, teacher educator, and researcher of mathematics learning and teaching. He was a keynote speaker at last September's Mathematics Education in Ireland conference in St. Patrick's College, Drumcondra. I'm going to introduce my interview with Ron Sewer by speaking to a first-class pupil named Laura. I showed Laura one strip of paper with 13 dots on it. I then covered the dots and wrote the numeral 13 over it. I showed Laura a second strip with 8 dots on it and wrote the numeral 8 above it. I then asked Laura to tell me how many dots on the strips altogether. Here is what she did.
I'm going to count all the dots.
Okay, so you're lifting off that page. Why is that?
Because I can't see them.
Okay.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18, 19, 20, 21.
So how many dots are there altogether?
There are 21 dots altogether.
In order to add the 13 and the 8, Laura used a strategy called counting all. She counted all the dots. I repeated the activity with 12 dots and 6 dots. But this time I asked Laura to figure out the answer by counting on from 12 rather than counting all. Here is our conversation.
12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17. 12 plus 6 equals 17.
How did you figure that out?
Because I started from 12 and I counted on 6 more.
And can you count out loud for me to show me how you did that? Because I can see you're using your fingers as well to help you, aren't you?
Yes, I am.
So show me again how you counted on from 12.
I went like 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18. I mean, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18. Sorry, it equals 18.
Okay, so you got 17 one time and you got 18 the other. Why was that?
I must have just counted a bit too fast and I got mixed up.
After an initial slip-up, Laura correctly calculated 12 plus 6 by counting on. When young children are learning to add two groups of objects and they know how many objects are in each group, say 8 cubes and 5 cubes, they can find the total number of cubes by counting all the cubes or by counting on from one of the numbers. In other words, for the group of 8 cubes and 5 cubes, they could start at 1, count up to 8 and then continue counting on to 13. Or they could start at 8 and count on just 5 to reach 13. Starting at the 8 is more efficient for children and also more difficult. Ron Sewer tells us why.
If you need to do 8 plus 5, you can't just, you don't know where to stop. So you need to know where to start. So 8 has to be a thing, not just when you counted the 8, but within a context of it's 8 and some more. The child knows 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13. But the child doesn't know that that is the case also for 8, 9. So the leap of where to start the count, and most importantly, when to stop, you have to monitor it. And the monitoring, if you think about it, there's a double count involved here. Okay, 8, then 9, and then 10, and then 11, and 12, and 13. And while I was counting, I was raising the 9. Again, it's not 9, it's 1. And the 10 is 2. I'm counting the second one while I'm accumulating. So it's a double count. And that's pretty much what we know about the brain and the process of learning, is that whenever coordination is involved, it's a conceptual leap. It's more difficult. And for the child, and the, also think about it, the child does have a way of doing it. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11. Why would the child start at 9? You think it's pretty straightforward. You would just show what you do, how you do. You start with 8, then you say 9, and you raise the finger, and then another one, and they teach them, they call it the fist system. And it's in books, it's in curricula in the United States. And the interesting thing is that for many kids, it doesn't work.
Another topic that is difficult for young children to master is multiplication. When children in Irish primary schools begin learning multiplication, they usually begin with what is called repeated addition. In other words, to find 3 times 5, you add 5 plus 5 plus 5. According to Ron Sewer, this is not helpful.
It actually is straying children away from the reasoning that is needed. And then when they get to later on to fractions, rational numbers, proportional reasoning and algebra, repeated addition is not supportive of the knowledge that they need. And so if they developed that way, it is it's really straying them away from the understanding they need to have to support much more sophisticated mathematics.
What children need to learn instead of repeated addition is multiplicative reasoning.
The issue of multiplicative reasoning, it is basically needed to support almost any piece of mathematics we do, but it is about the reasoning. It's not about just the facts. It's not about the algorithm. It's about the understanding of the relationship between units that is so different than when you just add them.
So being able to do multiplicative reasoning is more than being able to multiply two numbers. It's part of the place value system, for instance.
The system is based on exponents and multiplication, and you teach it to first graders who don't yet understand addition.
It matters too for fractions.
Think of a square. You cut it in half. Now you take one of the halves and cut that thing into half. So you have three parts. how much one of these parts is of the whole. It's not one-third, and they're not equal to one another. It's one-fourth, and it's one-fourth because the whole is four times as much of that part. It's a multiplicative relation. That's what you need to understand about fractions in order to do anything in algebra, anything in rational numbers, anything in decimals, anything that you need to understand. But if you think about part of a whole, you cannot even answer the question.
In order to develop multiplicative reasoning, Ransour recommends a game that he has developed called Please Go Bring Me, and it is geared for children in around third class. Later, he'll provide an email address that you can write to in order to get a free handout of the game. But first, he describes what children can learn by playing it.
The idea is basically that to learn to reason multiplicatively, you need to learn to think of a number as a composite unit. So 4 is not just 4 ones, 1, 2, 3, 4. It's also a thing in itself. And here's another 4, and here's another 4, and now you have 3 of those. So you need to think about the units that are involved and coordinate them in such a way that you distribute one across the others. And the game that we developed for that was trying to make sure, instead of talking about repeated addition, where you lose sight of the fact that you're coordinating units. And if you think repeated addition, like 2 apples plus 2 apples plus 2 apples, you just added and you got 6 apples. There's no change in unit. It's basically additive reasoning.
So how do children play Please Go Bring Me?
Say that you and I, Sean, are playing, and we're students, and we were now instructed to, I'm going to ask you, please go and bring me a tower of 5 cubes, and you're going to go to a box at the end of a playground and put together cubes that are singletons to get you, so you are creating the unit of 5, which is something you already have. We assume you have it. And then you bring it to me, and I say, how about you go and bring me another tower of 5? So you see, we now already are talking about 2 different units. You brought the ones into a 5, and now you're bringing another one of 5. So you have 2 units, 1, 2, that you use the same counting, but you're counting very different things than when you counted the ones. And you put that, and you are asked to bring another one. And at the end of this, there's a sequence of questions. And we're going to take turns. So then you're going to send me, and you're going to ask me the questions. How many towers did you bring? And how many cubes are in each? And how many cubes in all? And how did you know that this is the number? And we explain it, and we do a lot of variations, and we cover some of the units, and we do a lot of things that, you know, I'm not going to go into the details. But the underlying premise of this game is this: children, through the creation of the units and then asking the questions about it. It's the posing of the question that is more difficult for the kids. And when they get it, they start really seeing that we are addressing 2 different types of units, coordinating in the mind. It has to happen in the mind. And then the coordination creates a third type of unit. All those ones that populate the 5 times 3. And so they get a sense of the numbers.
When they hear about it first, some teachers think that Please Go Bring Me is too childish and the children won't like it. But when they try it, they find it works. Like this teacher Ron talked about.
We tried Please Go Bring Me. The kids were all over the place. They loved the game within 20 minutes. What they didn't get for 2 months, they got all the 4, you know, all the multiplication facts for 4. They loved it. They just enjoy it. A week or two later, they got the multiplication facts, which we know is, but that's not the goal. She was just elated by the fact they understood, and they could, as a result, actually, they say, I don't want to tell you, in the game, there's a place where you say, if I'm telling you, Sean, you're going to go and bring me 7 towers, 6 cubes in each, or 9 towers, 7 cubes in each. I'm using those hard numbers for the kids. But you don't have to bring one after another. You can bring all of them if you tell me how many cubes you're going to have. Or better, I need to prepare those cubes at the end of the box. I want to put exactly the number that you need for 9 towers, 7 cubes in each. How many cubes should I put there? If you know, tell me. You don't have to go and bring it. Now, if you have to go across the field 100 yards or so, you start thinking, well, how many would I have? And you start coordinating that. So it's not just fun. It really is pushing. There's a motivational aspect to it. That is, the coordination of the units makes sense to the child, and now they can work on it. And that's just one example. We do have a whole lesson plan for that. Teachers started using it, and they seem to have, kids definitely have fun, and the teachers seem to start making sense of it. So.
And where can teachers get that handout if they want to?
Well, probably email me, and you can put the email. It's ron.tzur, T-Z-U-R, @uc.edu. Denver, for University of Colorado Denver, ucdenver.edu. So they can always email me and say, we heard about this, please go bring me, we're so excited, can you share it with us, and blah, blah, blah.
When Ron Suhr addressed the Mathematics Education in Ireland conference last September, he talked about the relationship of teaching and learning. I asked him if he could elaborate on this.
If I'm a carpenter, my profession is to produce cabinets and tables and chairs and whatever. My profession is teaching. I need to help students produce knowledge so they can participate in our 21st technological society. They need to have the math, and I need to create situations that would allow them to do that. So what drives my tools are, you know, when a carpenter has a chisel and a hammer, and then they may have nails and they have a saw and whatever it is. So I have the tools of the trade, which are doing small group work or doing hands-on experiences. These should not replace what is I'm trying to do. I'm trying to help someone else build knowledge. And in order for me to do that, I better understand what that building process is. And my talk was all about trying to suggest that not only math educators, not only in university researchers, teachers, you and me going to first grade, working with the kids day in, day out, that's our profession. We need to have a way of thinking about the learning process that informs what we do.
This way of thinking is important when a teacher teaches something and the children just don't get it.
What do? I don't just call people at the university. I don't just go back to the book or just continue on as if nothing happened. I analyze what was going on for these students, why didn't they get it, and change my activities of teaching so learning will take place. And in order for that to happen, I need to have a tool of analyzing. The good news about the theory and the things that I was suggesting, that there is a need for what is theory? You know, people look at it like it's a bad word. It's basically the possibility of explaining something in a way that is sophisticated but it's simple but not simplistic. It's sophisticated. It explains the phenomenon and allows you to act in a systematic way. And the theory I was suggesting is basically that you start from where the students are, and you actually activate what they know, which seems to be counterintuitive to many teachers. Why would you teach and waste a very important instructional time on something that the kids already know?
So this is kind of revising what they already know, right?
Yeah, it's starting it, and then you revise. You help them transform what they know into something new that they did not know, but they have to use what they already know. Whenever we design a new learning experience, what does a student necessarily already know? How would that be transformed in the math that we want them to know, which they don't? I cannot just show them or tell them or say, do this, do that. But they can transform it. And the theory of learning that I'm using is a transformation based on what we know. And the teaching should pretty much follow it.
So given then that a teacher can't do the learning for the children, what does good mathematics teaching look like?
It has to be engaging, because as you probably noticed in the talk, that the first thing that happens in order for the transformation to happen, you have to act in a way that you are already familiar, and then that is happening because you have a goal, you have an intention. The student, the person who is doing the action, or the brain is always a goal-directed activity. What happens in the brain is always goal-directed. And that's now assumed by cognitive neuroscientists, by math educators, by psychologists, by anyway, everybody would say this is a goal-directed experience. So the goal, when you try, good teaching would suggest there is a goal, and goal is always coming. There's the cognitive aspect and then the affective aspect. There's the emotional, the child needs to be engaged. They need to, so going, for them, going and bringing those cubes is fun. Working with M&M and moving them around and grouping them to make groups of 10 is fun. But as the goal is evolving, it starts generating, because of it generates an activity and you do things, and suddenly there is an effect that you have to pay attention to. So the good teaching would create a situation where the child has a goal that is available through what they already know. And as a result of acting, they will now notice new things and would coordinate those two those new things into something that they did not have before. So the notion of reorganization here is based on their goal. And so good teaching would engage them in things that they know and take them to a place that is methodically, now it's not deterministic. They cannot, I cannot determine if a specific child at a specific time would actually learn to reason multiplicatively as a result of please go bring me. Please go bring me is not a deterministic thing. If you use it, all your kids will know multiplicative reasoning. I think it's important to communicate with teachers. But good teaching is one that it probably would work for most kids, because not because we tried it, but because it makes sense. And for those who it doesn't, you have a way of thinking, well, what happened? Did they not have number to start looking at it? Or do they not have additive reasoning at the place they need? Or the goal was not right, or they were not emotionally engaged. And there are lots of ways you do that. So the good teaching would include way of doing things on a consistent basis that students will be successful. And when they are not, you have as a teacher a way of thinking about it. Why was it not working?
So it's almost as if the goal of the teacher is to get the child to have their own goal of wanting to learn something.
It's really important to make a distinction. One of the aspects of the theory that is not here, it is in the paper in many places what we published, the theory of teaching and learning, that the teacher has to make a clear distinction between their goal for what the students would learn. I want the kids to understand multiplicative reasoning. I want them to have commutative property. I want them to have understanding of fraction. That's my goal for their learning. That cannot be their goal. If it could be their goal, they already know it. So they have to have a goal in the activity. The child's goal in the please go bring me is to bring the number of towers they were asked and to find out the total. They are not trying to learn to reason multiplicatively. That's what I try for them to do. So I'm not telling them, today we're learning how to multiply when we have equal groups. That doesn't make any sense to the child. They don't know what I'm talking about. Today we're going to play a game. Today we're going to do M&M and grouping. Today we're going to do fractions and French fry bars. And so the child has a goal inside the activity that inherent to the activity, it makes it a good thing to be engaged in.
And that was Professor Ron Suhr from the University of Colorado, Denver, who was a keynote speaker at the MEI conference last September. That's it for this week's Inside Education. You can listen to podcasts of previous programs on InsideEd.com or on iTunes. You can email us at InsideEducation@DublinCityFM.ie. Thanks to my guest, Professor Ron Suhr, and to our first class pupil, Laura. Also thanks to my colleague Barry Hennessy. Until the same time next week, this is Sean Delaney signing off. Thank you for listening.